the sex of Nordic gods. Oh, dearie me. They wear women's clothes and have cross-species relations. Masculine figures do supposedly female-coded stuff like Sather. Feminine figures do supposedly masculine-coded stuff like hunting and war. They marry their own siblings, make babies with trolls, and as everybody knows, the funniest thing in the world is to tie your balls to the goatee of a goat and make a little rope-pulling competition. When a masculine figure becomes pregnant as a woman with a stallion, then you might think that this is only debaucherous mythic reveries and that no such grotesqueries as horse sex would ever find its way into ritual suggestion. Well, you could go to my channel, watch this video here, and think again. You know, now why is the physicality and sexuality of the Nordics, other than humans, the gods and spirits, so out of the box? This video here is about applying a specific queer perspective in order to understand that. In a recent video on why it is so important to infuse contemporary wokeness with animist thinking, I compare the self-positioning of an imaginary ancien régime French nobleman with the self-positioning of an imaginary contemporary queer person. And perhaps there was a little bit of a suggestion of some sort of pompousness to that whole comparison. So in this video, I will desperately be struggling to redeem my heteronormatively freckled spectres by articulating why I actually think that queer perspective is in fact somehow really foundational to animism, even perhaps particularly from the position of a person such as myself, generally deplorably non-queer, which also means that, like almost anyone who doesn't hold a degree in queer studies or is an actual queer activist, I find this whole terminology a little bit complicated. But since we're still in the cultural process of, you know, negotiating how to figure out how to speak about these things, my strategy is to be chill about it, say what I think, I'm a firm believer in the basic insight of anthropology, which is that you have to step in it to learn. So if and when I say something stupid, just chill. There's no bad intention in it. You know, it's just me in the process of learning. Now, there's a lot of stuff to say about this queer Nordics field. So just a couple of words about what I'll not be talking about in this video. I'll not really go into the whole daunting topic of the ergi and the queerness of Sather, which are really central, actually, to Nordic's queer topic. But there are queer Viking scholars out there who are probably much better suited to deal with that than me. There are numerous fields, actually, that are perhaps surprisingly well-suited to queer perspective when you look at Nordic history of religions, but that I will not get into. Like, for instance, the queer nature of specific carnivalesque ritual queering. There are also art forms that I'll not go into that have strong queer aspects to them. Check this video here. What I will be looking at is a perspective on Nordic worldview that I think, you know, what our contemporary perspective could label queerness, you know, would be located at a very foundational place in basically the cosmic order of things. Queer as a cornerstone, basically, in the way the cosmic is constructed. Now, the word queer in English is derived from root meanings that are related to strangeness, something that is peculiar or out of the norm, askew somehow, off-center, appropriately different from straight. Right. The important thing is, I think, to zoom the queer perspective out, a little bit out from exactly who you prefer to have sex with and how your present sex aligns with the one that you were assigned at birth. Like, for instance, following the contemporary queer feminist thinker Donna Haraway, we can take a view of queerness which is a little bit more about rejecting rigid boundaries, those rigid boundaries of antagonistic Western dualisms, for instance, man versus woman, but also human versus animal, and importantly, human versus machine, actually. Haraway has this cyborg thinking. So what you have is bodies that are less clearly defined, they're less normative, they're less straight, somewhat peculiar, queer, you could say. Now, mythologies often operate with such blurred body lines in different ways. In the West African Yoruba myth that I know well, you find a lot of man-woman combination, a lot of trans motifs and androgyneity and these kind of things. In Greek myth, which I don't know as well, but my impression is that you have a lot of animal-human meetings and, you know, Zeus transforming into a swan and then having sex with a woman and stuff like that. And that, I think, is also characteristic of Nordic myth. But there's also another thing, which is very characteristically Nordic. And that is what you could call the open body, the permeable body, a kind of peculiarity of the body, that an askewness of body, a queered body part. Odin is missing an eye. This is an askewing, a queer bodily feature, you could say. And it actually gives him his character as a deity. It is the missing eye that makes him the seer. The queering of his body is the eye, which is in the well of wisdom, right? That is the divine eye. It is Loki's torn lips that makes him a talker, right? There's also something about Heimdall's hearing, actually, his ljóð, which is missing somehow, perhaps also in the all those wells somewhere. It is Tyr's missing hand which holds the wolf. He controls chaos by missing his hand. So he holds chaos with his missing hands, in a sense. So it is the skewness of the body that is the divinity of a Nordic deity. Gods are gods as a function of their queerness, right? The queerness of their body express or even generate their godhood somehow, right? At this point here, it builds on observations that I originally got from the British scholar Ross Downing, and I think it is so to the point of Nordic myth. And it's as if once you see it, then you can't stop seeing these missing bits and pieces all over the place. Not only body parts, but also, like, things. The god who shoots the arrow that kills the invulnerable Baldur is blind. He who kills the invulnerable is blind. Frey, masculinity, is missing his sword. This seems a pretty important thing to be missing if you're a deity of Viking masculinity, right? Freya is missing her necklace. If you look at this Viking age female jewelry here, I saw it at a museum recently. Could this have been basically a sign of feminine authority? Look how imposing it is. Well, the lady, Freya, is missing hers, it seems, right? And here comes the example that is the most amazing. And that is Thor losing his hammer. Thor's hammers are often found in female graves, actually, and yet they are clearly a sign of Thor's masculine power. Perhaps it's a phallic symbol somehow, and certainly a sacralizing tool. I also think that it symbolizes his thunderbolt. Some scholars don't believe that, but you know, I don't believe them. That's a different discussion. So Thor's hammer, the icon of this mega masculinity, right, Thor, is stolen. And in the lay, the Eddic lay, the Thrymskvida, this effeminizes Thor. In a sense, he becomes a woman when his phallus is taken, or a trans woman, as he dresses as a bride in order to be married to Thrym, the Jotun, right? Who now has his hammer, his masculinity. So Thor, as a female bride, comes to Thrym, and in the story, he actually gets married to Thrym by the ritual act of placing the hammer in the lap of the Thor bride, thereby sanctifying the marriage to Thrym. And this is a mythic story, which means that there are layers in it which are not symbolic, in a sense. It's not, a ritual is a ritual, there is no pretense, in a sense. And that implies that Thor actually, in a sense, receives the hammer, the phallus, in his lap, as he, as a woman, is wed to Thrym, or she, right? And this cosmic act of sexual effeminizes, effeminizing, realizes Thor as this mega masculine Thor that we know. He takes the hammer, takes in the hammer sexually almost, and then he kills the Jotnar with him. He becomes Thor by receiving his power, almost by being penetrated at it as a woman by the Thorness embodied in the hammer, right? It is as if he becomes Thor through this transsexual reception, right? How queer is that? Now I got some feedback and had a little debate with a trans woman that I showed this video to, and she had some really really great points about it and a little bit of criticism of my reading on this myth. What she pointed out is that there are perhaps aspects of ridicule to this Thor cross-dressing. Thor expresses his distaste in actually becoming feminized. And there is a note of perhaps hilarity to that whole thing there, right? And after a bit back and forth, I actually think that, you know, she has a point there. Totally. And yet it's not unambiguous. I think even the tension expressed in the hilarity over Thor cross-dressing, that essentially expresses an opposition between Thor's kind of masculinity and becoming a woman. And that in itself is perhaps not essentially oppressive at its root. It can become, perhaps it often is. But the fact that Thor doesn't want to contract ergi, become effeminized, and he expresses that resistance to being queered, I think that's also part of the transformative working of the tale. I don't think it is an expression of a norm that Thor, you know, adheres to more than or that humans should emulate. Gods do not act in ways that humans should imitate between each other. I think rather that this tension that is expressed here has to do with negation. And this is also why this is not queer empowerment, for instance, in Donna Haraway's sense of contemporary queer thinking, which would probably lean towards rejecting such boundaries and binarisms altogether. And hence the tension and the hilarity enforces that. And there would probably be a preference for there being no tension at all in the transformation that Thor undergoes. But this is a traditional queer perspective, if you can call it that. There is a tension here, and this transgression of sex still presumes rather distinct sexes. In fact, even an oppositional construction of sexes, or mirroring. So this traditional cosmic queering stands in a somewhat different spot, I think, than contemporary queer empowerment, because it does not negate Thor's masculinity to become a woman. But in that negation is also that power that births his masculinity. But the transgression is part of realizing it, right? So it's very queering, but it's not a rejection of distinction in the contemporary queer sense. And I also don't think that it implies a particular edge against, for instance, more standard ways of being a woman or being a man. As if that is somehow inherently problematic because it rests on the distinctions, right? So my intuition is that the queer traditionalism rather relates these in mutual connectedness, perhaps even dependence somehow. and even the fact that there can be laughing involved, I don't think it should necessarily only be read as a general statement about gender norms in these, you know, wildly gender transgressive universe, right? I do see the point, you know, that the hilarity of Thor as a trans woman has at least the potential of being ridiculing or being weaponized as such. But perhaps the tension in Thor's becoming trans is also part of the difference between this traditional animist queer worldview and more contemporary queer empowerment. And here I'm not finished understanding these things. So I'm not like posing a big preference for one or the other. I'm only sort of reflecting on the animist queering here. So, and gods, by the way, they're not unambiguously gendered. Personifications of thunder in later folklore regularly appears as females. And I think the strict focus on transgression of gender categories come from a research tradition where people has had this weird obsession with believing that they had understood stuff once it was, categorized as either masculine sphere or feminine sphere, you know. In fact, there are a number of Nordic deities whose gender seems to be not completely settled somehow. Nertus was a goddess who then became the masculine god Njörður, right? And as a man, he is chosen, if not actually taken, as a spouse in this very passive way by this extremely agented female figure, Skadi, right? And she is, in fact, believed to by some to be similar to the masculine god Ullr, that might have been the same deity, just male in some parts of Scandinavia and female in other parts of Scandinavia. So in this Njörður Skadi constellation, there seems to be some serious gender fluidity going on. When people find, for instance, this little female-dressed Odin-like figure, then what's going on? You know, was Odin trans? There are suggestions that he could have had this role in Eddic poetry. Or was he just a goddess in some parts of Scandinavia, or wearing female clothes? Or, you know, there's so many possibilities are available there. I think the myth of Thor might reflect also an initiatory logic. That moment where Thor becomes a woman that realizes his masculinity. And you find similar logics in masculine initiations in New Guinea, actually, where young men they're molded into the kind of men who have sex with women through what we would call homosexual sex in ritual situations. Just as a side note, and in fact, when you look at initiations in different cultures, you do see laughing in relation to the kinds of negations that effectuate an initiatory transformation. We are sort of predisposed to think that religion is this super not playful, not erotic, and gender sexuality is a super solemn issue itself, you know. And I would again recommend my video. That has a very different take on both issues. But from an overall perspective, you know, notice, you know, how this, what we could call the queer body, is really cosmically central. It is the eschewing, the queerness that is somewhere at the root of the divine itself. Isn't that wonderful, you know, and radical and pretty cool, you know? It's a worldview that doesn't focus on some Garden of Eden where everything's perfect and planned and fit neatly together in bourgeois little categories put into place by some powerful ultra-patriarchal father deity, you know. In the Nordic material, even the all-father Odin is pretty queer and effeminized deity, actually, whose power relies on, a bit like Thor almost, on this effeminizing. His Sæðr, he gets a Sæðr through effeminizing. You see similar traits, by the way, in the West African Yoruba all-father, Oshala or Obatala, who is also a gender-ambiguous all-father deity. So this is a worldview not of systemic, planned consistency, but where stuff is acknowledged as problematic, as incomplete, troublesome, and the imperfections are perhaps what makes divinity, what makes us divine, perhaps. Isn't that just at its root like life-affirming and positive attitude to real life, you know? And in fact, I think you can see this throughout animist culture. For culture isn't, you know, a perfectly organized machine where everything makes sense and it's more of a universally skewed mess, which is held together by relational, you know, seasonal celebrations, for instance. They aren't organized in these aesthetically symmetric system, you know. It's much more of a universally skewed mess, directed by nodes of transformation through which are in relation, right, which establish relation. When for instance, I put together the elements of the traditional calendar into the Wheel of Seasons, I actually had this in mind, that this is not this sort of well-ordered, symmetric image. And in a sense, that made it really easy because I didn't have to change much. I just took traditional calendar elements and merged them into this design because I didn't feel obligated to organize them into crosses and stars and squares and all that stuff. I wanted, as Haraway formulates it, to stay with the trouble and not to run for the systemic, unambiguous, well-ordered model, but to acknowledge the animist cosmos as fundamentally queer in a sense. And I think this is part of making this design powerful. And with Ave Nielsen's design, I find it have to have become a magnificently organic and complex, you know, expression, you know. Because the queer, what Haraway calls the trouble, is at the root of how reality is organized, right? And let me just turn to a more quite contemporary issue that I've been thinking a bit about. And just because it's interesting and because I've mentioned in the last video and, you know, perhaps with a touch of ambiguity, you know, about how to be work about, you know, without being an ass. And that is the proliferation of new and gender-inclusive ways of using pronouns, which, as I said in that video, I basically read it as a very culturally appropriate way of practicing cultural respect relation. For instance, the use of plural, they. I'll just expand a little bit of that, because it's actually a very standard way of talking in many Indo-European languages. It's very common to use plural when addressing people politely. In Scandinavia, we used to say they instead of you. In fact, English you is already derived from a plural form, ye, as opposed to an older and more original singular form, thou, thee, right? Our monarch in Denmark, she even used to speak of herself as we, but we the Queen of Denmark. But that started feeling like decidedly archaic, even in an actual constitutional monarchy. So she dropped doing that. and it's a general thing in Indo-European languages that elders are being addressed in the plural somehow, and you know, sometimes through history, even principals or bishops have been addressed as with the plural. You also see it in non-Western cultures, in both the Bible and the Quran, God is pluralized. But between people, I think it's basically a form of being polite. It's like saying sir. And the important thing about politeness or conduit, you know, is that there are different cultural and personal preferences. Some individuals prefer to stay a little bit at a formal distance. They don't feel like us coming and imposing our whole intimacy on them, or they just feel more adequately represented with specific forms. You know, for instance, contemporary Scandinavians are extremely informal. A young Danish student, he told me that it was really weird for him to address his American Ivy League professor by last name. Professor last name, you know. And I told him, dude, you have to swallow that right away. You can't go on and just like first name and Ivy League professor like that. Hey, Catherine, you know, doesn't work. You know, I was myself given a similar instruction actually by my French mother-in-law. I had written a professor in Paris and I used title plus last name, Professor Capone. That's actually her name. But my mother-in-law told me in Parisian academia, that was too intimate, informal. I should have used third person plus title, you know, le professeur, the professor. So I was under-formalizing. However, at a skiing holiday with my in-laws, there was a bit of an awkward silence when I raised my glass and proposed a toast for my brother-in-law and his wife, who had gone through the trouble of arranging the whole thing. But in this French family context, that felt like completely weirdly, over-courtly, medieval Arthurian. And I felt totally Monty Python over-formalizing. Hey, okay. So this is just, there are different preferences for social form. That's all there is to it. And it can sometimes seem a little bit kind of random, but it's basically human ways of showing respect, you know? And the important thing is, that when you encounter a human requirement to comply with specific forms and language, you the fuck comply. You know, and this is a requirement for interacting with humans. Wherever you are, whenever you are, you just do it, you know. But if you are one of those people who needs more reason to address people in the way that they ask for than this universal fact of human existence, then consider the cosmically central role played by queerness in Nordic worldview. I actually think that it particularly behooves people who lean towards Nordic animism or Nordic traditional religiosity to show respect and to use the appropriate pronouns, meaning the ones that people ask you to use. And it's weird, actually, that someone finds the use of plural to be strange and unnatural, because it's actually so culturally rooted. You know, it can almost be labeled traditionalist. You know? But concerning the Nordic worldview, there are, in fact, many symbols in the Nordic heritage that express or encapsulate this queerness. Many have caught on to Loki, the trickster, with this, which is, I think, is a wonderful invention in our age, and I'm sure that Loki loves it. But this being as foundational as it is, this, the queer aspect, I think there are many other symbols in the Nordic queer cosmos. The mosque, for instance. Mosques are a mix between a human and something else. I think mosques have an aspect of cyborg to them, the mix between the human and the machine, right? Or the tool, something like that. Another important symbol is, of course, the raven, which shows the human merge with the animal body. And this merging, you know, I think is a characteristically Nordic animist symbol of how the skew body in Haraway sends the queer body is important. You could also mention the bractates, whose human bodies are very open, very queer, often merging with animals, or also sometimes gender. You know, I already made a video about that. But I want to also mention one example that I really like, and that is the Tyr rune. The Tyr rune. Now, as demonstrated by the scholar Jonna Louis Jensen, the Norwegian rune poem describes the shape of the runes with visual associations. She convincingly argues that the Norwegian rune poem uses visual associations between the shape of the runes and stuff in the world as a mnemonic tool to memorize the runes. And check out what Ole Worms writes in the 17th century, early 17th century, about the Tyr rune. He writes, "Tyr denotes a bull which punches the earth with its horns. But when it appears with only one horn, the left one, in a distinguished way, then that can be seen in this way. Then it is said to refer to the idol, Tyr in the old times, about which the Edda says that he was deprived of a hand by the wolf." Right? The normal form of the rune that you might know is an image of the bull. Tyr also means a bull in Scandinavian languages. But in this form, it has been made askew. It is queer, and that is what makes it divine. It is now the idol of Tyr, a deity whose names literally mean a god in general, who lost his hand one by binding the wolf, right? Yeah, so I just want to spit that one out there. You know, if I was a queer animist or queer heathen, I would totally consider using that. I think the queerness is very visible in this square, or very directly represented in this skew or queer rune, according to Worms. it's like it's a direct image of the divinely queered body. So yeah, thanks for listening. My name is Rune Jarne Rasmussen. The work that I'm sharing with you on this channel focuses on recovering Euro-traditional animist knowledge. This is the fruit of a life of study and research all over the world, and I hold a doctorate from the oldest university in the Nordic region, but I'm choosing to popularize rather than to focus on academic publication. Conventional institutions, however, have yet to warm up properly to my perspective. So if you appreciate what I do, then please do consider that I also need to feed my family. For the price of less than one beer per month, you can become a patron supporter. or you can head over to my webshop and enter into exchange relation with me. You can also give single donations to my PayPal account, or if you have contact with someone that might help me project this incredibly important perspective to the world, then do drop me a PM. And remember also to clickety-click and subscribe, follow, share, comment, and all that. Thank you very much.